You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Mitt Romney is literally recycling a Saturday Night Live skit as a proposal for a Romney presidency. I am not making this up. Saturday Night Live, back, oh, geez, must have been years ago. Hulu Plus, Tom Hanks did this. It was 1992. Okay, back in 1992, Saturday Night Live did this skit where they said, if I'm president, the guy running for president says, if I'm president, we get 0% growth, you don't pay me nothing. He was pretending he was Ross Perot. 1% growth, hell, a chimpanzee could run this country and make 1% growth, so don't pay me dime one. Got my own plane, don't need Air Force One. State dinners, I'll pay it. It's nothing to me and on a beach. Now, don't worry about old Ross Perot. I got $3 billion back at home. That was the Saturday Night Live skit. Mitt Romney today, talking to Neil Bortz, he says, if he becomes president and he performs well in the White House, then pay him more. If not, pay him less. He says, I don't believe in linking my incentives and my commitment to the accomplishment of specific goals. Yeah. Anyhow, coming up in our first hour, speaking to Mitt Romney, I have a theory about why Mitt Romney lies. Justin Frank, the guy who wrote Bush on the Couch and Obama on the Couch, he has a theory. I'll share that with you. I'll share with you my theory. And let's do a reality check on this. Why is it that Mitt Romney lies so easily and so frequently? And according to Justin Frank, he actually believes his own lies. In our second hour today, the gun rights nuts now want citizens to be able to stand your ground and shoot first with police officers. Yeah. How far is this going to go? I mean, how far has this already gone? People all over the country are dying because of this stuff. And in our third hour today, get ready for the F word again, because it can happen here. And I'll tell you who rang the warning bell besides me. Hint. It was the Vice President of the United States in 1944. All of that in our third hour today. And what, you know, and how it ties into what could happen in this country if there's a Romney presidency. And tomorrow, by the way, Ravi Batra, by popular demand, is back. The economist, the author, New York Times, and internationally best-selling author on books on economics. He's joining me for our third hour tomorrow, taking questions from you about the economy. So get your questions ready. So anyhow, Dr. Justin Frank, I mentioned that he wrote Bush on the Couch. We had him on this program, in fact, back in, 2003, 2004, whenever that book came out. He's a psychiatrist and a professor of psychiatry. He wrote Bush on the Couch. He wrote Obama on the Couch. He's got a book about, psychoanalyzing Obama. Why does he do what he did? It has to do with how he was raised. Typical kind of, shrink stuff. He's now turned his psychoanalytic powers on Mitt Romney in a piece for Time magazine titled The Root of Mitt Romney's Comfort with Lying. Yeah, this is the title of a piece in Time magazine, The Root of Mitt Romney's Comfort with Lying. And what Justin Frank says is it's not just Romney's flip-flops on this whole wide variety of issues. Abortion, he was pro-life, then he was pro-choice, stem cell research, he was in favor of it, now he's opposed to it. Maybe he's in for it again, I don't know. The assault weapons ban, he was for it, then he was against it, then he was for it, then he was against it. Global climate change, civil unions for gays, Obamacare, also known as Romney Care. In fact, here's just a little short clip that we've put together that has a couple of Romney, you could call them flip-flops. Justin Frank calls them lies. Here you go.
You can look at my record as governor, and you can see in my record as governor that I have consistently been pro-life.
I believe that abortion should be safe and legal in this country.
I believe, based on what I read, that the world is getting warmer. And number two, I believe that humans contribute to that.
So the idea of America spending massive amounts, trillions of dollars to somehow stop global warming is not a great idea.
I have never supported the President's Recovery Act, all right, the stimulus. No time, nowhere, no how have I supported the President's stimulus.
I think there is need for economic stimulus.
So there you go. Now, and that's just three of them, right? That's the low-hanging fruit. So as Dr. Frank points out, Romney recently lied about a book by an author by the name of Noam Schieber, who said in his, what Romney said was that the book that this guy wrote said that Obama knew that Obamacare would slow down the economy. Well, in fact, Obamacare hasn't slowed down the economy, and it's nowhere in the book. The book says no such thing. And the author, Mr. Schieber, went on national television to say, hey, my book doesn't say that. Romney's lying. And, you know, Romney knew this. I mean, his campaign knew this. Everybody knew this, that the author was saying, I never said that. It's not in my book. Stop saying that. But a week later, Romney comes out and he says it again. And then he puts it in an ad. And then he says it again in a radio interview. Then he says it on a TV interview. Then he says it in a bunch of speeches. He keeps repeating the very same lie with a totally straight face, seeming like he totally believes what he knows is a lie. How can he do that? Dr. Frank suggests that Romney is so comfortable with lying. In fact, he says, you know, this is behavior that's installed before you're 10 years old. He says he's been doing it pretty consistently throughout his entire political career, and there's every reason to believe that skill helped him make $250 million at the vulture equity firm Bain Capital. He's so comfortable with lying because of his Mormon upbringing. Now, Dr. Frank's logic is that Mormon has built into it, my read of Dr. Frank's logic is that Mormon has built into it a number of things that are inherently contradictory. For example, God tells Mormons to take multiple wives, but Mormons don't do it. Or the black, or that in the Book of Mormon, God says black people were cursed by God in the Mark of Cain, but since the 1970s, Mormons let them in the church. Stuff like this. And because Romney's willing to believe that God or the church are right on contradictory things, something that's impossible, he's been conditioned by his religious faith, according to Dr. Justin Frank, the psychiatrist, to be comfortable with what you and I would call lies. Now, it's a nice theory, and it might be true, but I'm very skeptical. I mean, here's my problem with that theory. There are a lot of good Mormons out there. I know one personally who believe the stories in the Book of Mormon, follow the church, and in their daily lives are not regular liars like Mitt Romney is. In fact, you could make the same argument that Justin Frank makes about Mitt Romney being a liar because he was raised in a religion that's, you know, full of weird things. You can make that same argument for any of the major religions. God told Jews, Muslims, and Christians that they should kill their children if they disrespect their parents. It's right there in the Ten Commandments. None actually do that today. And that cognitive dissonance doesn't turn religious people into pathological liars. And that's one of, you know, dozens of examples in the Bible. So with all due respect to Dr. Frank, I'd suggest that the real answer to why Mitt Romney chronically lies is much simpler to explain. He's a sociopath. Sociopaths don't have to be serial killers. In fact, most of them aren't. Sociopaths are people who lack the ability to understand or empathetically feel the pain or other experiences of other living things. A sociopath, for example, would have no problem tying his dog to the roof of his car for a 10-hour ride because a sociopath has never had the experience of empathizing with a dog, feeling what a dog feels. A sociopath, for example, would have no problem shutting down a well-functioning and profitable steel mill, throwing hundreds of people into poverty, depression, divorce, and suicide because a sociopath thinks that he's the only real human in the world, the only one who has real feelings. That's the core of what it means to be a sociopath. And high-functioning sociopaths, people who are smart and well-educated and are sociopaths, make up as much as 10% of major participants in Wall Street. Keep in mind, Mitt Romney's a bankster. And they may well make up the majority of CEOs in major firms. I mean, there's certainly probably all of the CEOs of the tobacco companies in America, for example. So instead of being surprised that Romney lies so easily, you know, we should be surprised.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We should be surprised that more former CEOs, all sociopaths, haven't showed up in presidential politics. Which I guess brings us to George W. Bush.
The way you lie. You lie like a priceless Persian rug on a rich man's
floor. So, you know, as I said, a sociopath, let's just get right down to clinical definitions, okay? There's been no shortage of really fascinating books written over the years about sociopaths. Sometimes they're referred to as psychopaths. But I think if we're talking about a guy who's running for president of the United States, using the word psychopath is just seems a little too strong. I throughout the Bush presidency, this is one of the programs, and I, you know, I took a lot of flack for it from the right wingers saying that I was doing hate radio, quack, quack, quack. But I will continue to say, and I really genuinely believe that George W. Bush is a sociopath. A sociopath is a person who doesn't view other people as fully human, as real. He thinks he's the only person in the world who actually feels real emotions, and everybody else is like a chess piece on a chessboard. And, you know, back in 1999, George W. Bush told Mickey Herskowitz, and we've got the audio of Cindy telling this story, whose son died in Iraq, telling the story of what George W. Bush told Mickey Herskowitz. Okay. Cindy Sheehan. Yeah. So anyhow, we've got that clip. And basically what George W. Bush said was that his father blew it by only having a 100-hour-long war with Iraq. That if he became president, he was going to have a more substantial war. In other words, he was going to do it not because the war was necessary, but because it would give him political capital so he could privatize Social Security. So he would have a successful presidency and do all the things. Well, here's Cindy Sheehan testifying before John Conyers' committee under oath in front of Congress, quoting, and Mickey Herskowitz is on the record about this. This is not a secret. This has been in the newspapers, as they say. Here it is.
As a matter of fact, in interviews in 1999 with respected journalist and longtime Bush family friend Mickey Herskowitz, then Governor George Bush stated, "One of the keys to being seen as a great leader is to be seen as commander-in-chief. My father had all this political capital built up when he drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, and he wasted it. If I have a chance to invade, if I had that much capital, I'm not going to waste it. I'm going to get everything passed that I want to get passed, and I'm going to have a successful presidency," end quote.
There you go. So that's Cindy Sheehan laying it out, and then she adds, you know, it looks like my son Casey was doomed even before he joined the military in 2001. And he was, because it was 99 that Bush decided he was going to have a war for political purposes. So, as I said, high-functioning sociopaths, this is the core of a sociopath, is, you know, easy facility with lying, being very charming, and not viewing other people as human. And high-functioning sociopaths, as in smart and well-educated sociopaths, make up as much as 10% of the major participants on Wall Street. There have been some interesting studies on this. One of them was published in Forbes magazine, of all places. And they make up the majority, in my opinion, of CEOs at major firms. I mean, this is why CEOs get paid so much. Why would you pay the head of a healthcare company $1 billion? Bill McGuire made over $1 billion running the United Healthcare Company. Why on earth would any corporation say, we got to pay this guy $1 billion? He actually made $1.7 billion. $1,700 million. $1,700 million for 10 years' work. Why would a company have to pay so much money? You would think that there's lots and lots of people who have a, you know, college degree and business experience and understand the business world who can run a company, right? Well, not so much. Not when the company has as the primary core of its business model, we make profit by letting people die. Whether it's a tobacco company or a health insurance company, that's the core of their business model. The more people who die from tobacco, the more money the CEOs make. The more people who die because they are denied health insurance. Oh, you've got a pre-existing condition. I'm sorry, your child was born with a genetic defect. You can't get insurance. You know, you forgot to fill in that back when you were a teenager, you were on whatever that drug is, Accutane or whatever it is that causes cancer when you grow up. You forgot to tell us that, so we're not going to pay for your cancer. What kind of person can run a company like that and give the order to do that? to say no to people and let them die. What kind of person can do that and sleep at night? Only a sociopath. So if only 1% of the population is sociopaths, and, you know, some of them end up, many of them end up in prison, but some of them end up going to the best schools, come from wealthy families, go to good schools, they learn how to fit in, they know how to blend in, they know how to look like an average person, and they become George W. Bush or Mitt Romney, or the CEO of a health insurance company or a tobacco company. And there's so few of them that you got to pay them a lot of money, because it's really hard to find people like Mitt Romney who can sleep at night after having just shut down a steel mill and destroyed 700 families. He's got no problem sleeping at night. He's a sociopath. So, as I said, instead of being surprised that Romney lies easily, repeatedly, and constantly, which he does, I mean, this is well demonstrated, he even tells lies about his lies. He changes his positions the way that you and I change our shoes. Instead of being surprised about that, frankly, I'm surprised that there aren't more sociopathic CEOs who are stepping into politics, although we're starting to see it now. Look at Donald Trump knocking on every door there is. I mean, he's not running for political office, but he wants to be a player. Look at these, you know, these big-time multimillionaires and billionaires who are stepping up saying, ha-ha, yeah, I'll throw some money around. How do you think they got that money? How many people did they have to step on to get to where they are? And then there's George W. Bush. Remember his lies to us about WMDs so that he could have his wars? I mean, hopefully one day soon the American people are going to wake up to the fact that having sociopaths transition from business to government is bad.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And it's not just bad in a micro sense. It's bad in a macro sense. It's bad for us. It's bad for the world. So your thoughts. You think Romney's a sociopath? Back, Tom Hartman here with you. And the question that I'm asking is, what is the basis of this? I mean, it's almost axiomatic that politicians lie, right? It's an old cliche. But the fact of the matter is that a politician who lies so easily and so frequently and so publicly and so shamelessly is really a pretty unusual thing. You know, Richard Nixon lied about his connections to the mob, but he was consistent in that lie, and they were mostly lies of concealment. But you always knew where his politics were. From when he first ran for Congress in 1946 until he resigned in 1973, you always knew where his politics were. You always knew. I mean, Ronald Reagan famously switched from being a Democrat to a Republican after he married Nancy Davis, and her father sat him down and said, son, you want to become rich? Let me hook you up with GE, and, you know, we'll, or whatever. I mean, I don't know all the details of it, but there are, as they say, there are stories. Whether it was a cynical move or whether it was a heartfelt move. Actually, I'm going to suspend judgment on that. But the fact of the matter is that we knew where he stood when he was a Democrat, and then he became a Republican, and we knew where he stood as a Republican. John Adams screwed up his presidency terribly. But we all knew that. I mean, everybody knew. He was a curmudgeon. It's really rare. Bill Clinton, he lied about sex. Okay, I think we can all understand that. You don't have to be a sociopath to not want your wife to know that you had an affair. This is. I mean, you know what? 68%, I think, of married men, and 52%, as I recall the numbers, something like that, of married women have had affairs. I mean, this is part of the human condition. Those are not the kinds of things that I'm talking about. I'm talking about that 1% of people who can tell a lie in an absolutely convincing fashion, who can change their position on a dime depending on what is necessary, and have no second thoughts about it at all, no remorse, who have no core. Is it, as Justin Frank proposes, and my apologies to Dr. Frank if I'm mangling his perspective, you can read it over at Time Magazine's website, time.com, is it that this came out of Romney's Mormon faith? There are others who suggest it's because he watched his mother, who was an aspiring actress when she married his father. She ran for the United States Senate from Michigan and was badly defeated and badly beaten up in that, you know, politically speaking, in that race. And his father ran for president, was defeated Is it that Ed Romney was a young man when that happened? Is it that he learned from that experience that he should lie? Or is it that he's just a sociopath? How do you know? Renee in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Renee, what do you think?
I just want to, I do believe that he is a full-blown sociopath, and also the problem with sociopaths is that nobody ever calls them on any of their lies.
Or very rarely, yes, because they're
very
so
rarely.
Charming, so convincing. They can be so emphatic. They'll double down. I mean, it's just, it goes on and on. Who is the guy who wrote People of the Lie? Was his name Gray? He was a psychiatrist. This was about a decade and a half, 2 decades ago.
I don't recall.
Okay. There are just some remarkable books about, you know,
yes.
kind of the evil among us, the sociopaths among us. The Sociopath Next Door, actually, is the title of another
Martha
book.
Martha Stout, yes.
Yeah.
Martha Stout, The Sociopath Next Door. But
yeah.
It's true. I mean, that nobody, I know some sociopaths in this town that are in high-level positions that are in charge of taking care of actually, like, people's lives and well-beings, and they get away with it.
Yep. And Shane tells me the psychiatrist who wrote... the People of the Lie was M. Scott Peck. That was the first book that I read that really, whoa, you know, and this was maybe 25 years ago. Thank you very much, Renee. Thanks for the call. Chris in Denver. Hey, Chris, what's up?
How's it going, Tom? You know, I do believe that a large percentage of CEOs probably, you know, suffer from some sort of, you know, psychopathic condition, but, you know, David Sirota brought up a great point. I really believe him, you know, a couple weeks ago that, you know, CEOs that, you know, do corrupt things, that, you know, hurt people to maximize profits. I think a lot of times maybe we can, you know, look at a system as a whole and say that it's corrupt because CEOs, you know, legally act within their own, you know, obligations. I mean, the shareholders could, you know, bring a lawsuit against the CEO if he doesn't, you know, maximize profits.
Right. So what you have is a situation, it's sort of like saying, you can only practice medicine if you have a medical degree. Right, so you have to have certain qualifications in order to become a physician. You can only become a CEO if you can operate within a sociopathic culture, environment, because a corporation is by definition a sociopath. It has no conscience whatsoever. It has a singular purpose, which is to make profit, which does not benefit necessarily other human beings. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. And a CEO is part of that milieu. And so it shouldn't surprise us that Mitt Romney, having been the CEO of a vulture capital firm, Bain Capital, the vulture equity firm, that he'd be a sociopath. I mean, surprise, surprise. Maybe my big revelation is like just obvious to everybody and has been all along. I don't know. Ray in Batavia, Illinois. Hey, Ray, what's up?
Hi. One of the things that I believe that causes basically candidates not picking on Mitt over here, but others, that advance, I think because the short memory of the American people. What they say and what they do a week ago or a few weeks ago, we're so involved in our daily lives. We're trying to basically make ends meet at best here,
right,
post-2008 financial crisis. So they actually can leverage the short memory of the American people to basically say things and do things that they know, and this has worked for a long period of time, that after a while, the American people will not remember it or vaguely remember it, or they're so actually deep into involved with their daily lives trying to basically survive.
Yeah.
That
yeah. And then that provides an environment where the candidate can simply shake the Etch-a-Sketch and reboot it. Excellent point, Ray. Thank you for the call. Dale in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hey, Dale.
Hey, Tom. Hey, you know, his religion absolutely has something to do with why he lies so easily for several reasons. Now, I don't disagree that he's a sociopath. I think that's clear from where he's risen in business and all your arguments for it.
Well, but right down to his being a bully in high school, by the way, which is an early indicator of sociopathy.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But within the Mormon religion itself, lying for the religion to promote and to advance the religion is acceptable. You can read a myriad of books that have been written on Mormon history and even, you know, modern Mormon history. Martha Beck, in her book, Leaving the Saints, described how her father, Hugh Nibley, falsified footnotes and references in his books that he wrote. He was an apologist, a writer for the Mormon Church. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the history of the purges from Brigham Young University, when you look clean back to Joseph Smith lying, but the second part of his lies.
Let me just, if I may, before you move on, that's sure. Not, you know, the idea of the noble lie is not unique to Mormonism. It you know, it's been used by popes, it's been used by preachers, it's been used by governments, it's been around for a long, long time, that the ends justify the means.
Certainly.
Doesn't make it right, but it's, you know.
The fact that clearly part of their theology has to do with getting a president in the United States. One of their ideas of making this one nation Mormon nation, this one nation under God, as another writer, Baines, I think is his name, clearly showed they have an agenda to get a president in. And so he'll do anything and say anything to achieve that, and not even think about the lies that he's telling, because to him it's for that noble cause.
Right. And so, and in fact, isn't there a Mormon prophecy that when the United States is, as I recall, the phrase was hanging by a thread, or the Constitution was hanging by a thread, that a
Absolutely.
Mormon would become president of the United States and save the Republic?
Absolutely, Tom, and that's what I'm referring to, yeah.
Yeah, okay. We need to dig a little deeper into that. Dale, thank you very much for the call. Monica in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Monica.
Yes, I want to disagree with your statement that George Bush was a sociopath. I don't believe he is, because if you think about it, what he was saying about his father's war, I think the fact that his father didn't get put on a pedestal for his presidency is more or less what was going on there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
but what Bush said he was willing to do was start a war, which means killing people in order to privatize Social Security, in order to get the political capital so that he could do what he had campaigned unsuccessfully in 1977 for the House of Representatives on.
Yeah, but that...
I mean, the Taliban came to him after 9/11 and said, we've got Osama bin Laden. He lives here in Afghanistan. We will arrest him and give him to you as long as he goes to a third neutral country for trial, like a Nuremberg trial. We'll hand him over. Would you like him? And George W. Bush said, no, we'd rather have a war. And he started bombing Afghanistan. That, to me, doesn't seem like something that Churchill or Eisenhower would have done. That, respectfully, Monica, I genuinely think George W. Bush was and is a sociopath. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I'm wondering, you know, is that the case with Mitt Romney? I mean, he doesn't seem like that evil a guy, that nasty a guy, but... So why is it that people don't push back against sociopaths? Well, everybody said Ted Bundy was such a nice guy. No, I'm not kidding, and I'm not being facetious. He worked the suicide hotline. And then he'd go out and eat people. So, it's like, not that Mitt Romney wants to eat people. Although his dog would probably tell you that. Anthony in Eureka. Hey, Anthony. Thanks for listening to KGOE. What's up?
Tom, we were discussing this, Mike Papatoni, of the sociopathy of these 1% gangster banksters.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the conundrum. Why can we not prevail over them? I would like to suggest the reason is this. We do not respond to the bankers as if they are insane. Instead, we respond to them as if they are sane civic citizens and offer them rational arguments.
Yep.
May I respectfully offer two ways of properly responding to them?
Go for it.
One, the election campaign should be sophisticated, psychological portrayals of them showing how unempathic and predatory they are. Second, the talk show host should indeed have Justin Frank and other PhD psychologists psychoanalyzing these sociopaths on a daily basis.
Okay. All right. Justin Frank, by the way, just for the record, is an MD. He's a psychiatrist. But point made. Point made. That's even higher on the food chain. Luke in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Luke, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Love your show. And I love this topic. I've been contemplating this for years. I look at this. This is why evolution should be taught in school, because it's an exercise in logic.
Yes.
And politics is a path of least resistance for sociopaths.
For many, yes.
Yeah, it can't. A sociopath doesn't operate well in a world in a meritocracy, because a sociopath would have to disregard a lot of selfish tendencies to exercise well in a meritocracy. But when it comes to politics, it's easy to lie, it's easy to charm, it's easy to do all that stuff.
And if you've got a quarter of $1 billion like Mitt Romney does, 4 years ago, you could spend $30 or $40 million of your own money like he did to put yourself number two in line, as he did, knowing that when the Republican Party, the guy who's number two 4 years later is always number one and the nominee.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm a big advocate for democracy, but I think this is another reason why we need regulation. I mean, like you said with the corporations. Corporations, by their very definition, are predatory. They can't be. People get fired if they're not.
Yeah, they're sociopaths.
You know, we have laws that say you cannot put tigers in rooms with babies.
Yeah, yeah, there you go. And why are we then, allowing a health insurance company that pays its CEOs over $1 billion to even exist, much less, put it at the center of a healthcare system? Thank you, Luke. Very well said. Cliff in Santa Barbara, California. Hey, Cliff, what are your thoughts
on this? Santa Clarita. Hey, Tom, it's been a while.
Santa Clarita, I'm sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Great, great topic. First of all, I absolutely believe Mitt Romney is a sociopath, and you've given good examples of that, but I'd like to remind you of a couple examples from George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, he tortured animals as a child, which is a pretty classic, example. Second of all, when there was a time when he was in the White House and he was joking about looking for the WMDs under the couch.
Yep.
Remember that?
Yeah, that was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Yes.
Yeah,
I remember it well.
And then, they're not under here, they're not under here.
Yep.
And then another thing is when this Katrina happened at the Superdome, remember his mom was commenting that most of these people were disadvantaged to begin with?
Right, and so she wasn't going to...
pretty well for them.
Right, yeah, it worked out pretty well for them, and she was, in fact, we have the clip of that. And she said she's not going to bother her beautiful mind with it.
You see, I mean, so where do you think?
The apple didn't fall far from the tree.
Far from the tree, exactly.
Yeah. So, I think that, yes, actually, I'll just leave it at that. I think you said it very well. Thanks, Cliff. Eric in Erie, Pennsylvania. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Tom. I got the sociopath trifecta for you. You ready?
Sure.
William Bratton, former NYPD chief of police. Amadou Diallo, sociopath act number one. He gets promoted upward in the private sector to Kroll Incorporated, private background intelligence firm. He's CEO of them. They're getting sued in federal court. They claim as a defense, we're a private business entity. We cannot be guilty of a civil rights violation because we don't act under the color of state law. So they get out of the complaint there. They dodge the lawsuit bullet there. They're taken into state court, sued on the same case in Landon v. Kroll, K-R-O-L-L. And in state court, they say, whoa, we can't be responsible for this because we were acting in a prosecutorial function and are therefore entitled to judicial immunity.
As a contractor for the government. Yeah, it's...
Precisely. So, but they're three-way. And Bill Bratton, Amadou Diallo says the tale there.
Yeah.
But this company, they're completely untouchable, and they're like brazen with it. They don't even think about... Forget about their opponent, their adversary,
right,
in a litigation.
I can't speak to that company. I don't know the details as well as you do, apparently.
Like,
but I can tell you that there is no shortage of defense contractors and military companies that use those twin and bizarre kinds of logic. On the one hand, saying, you can't come after us. We're acting as on behalf of the state. And then when you come after them, and by the way, we're a private company. You can't hold us accountable under the laws. Justin in Santa Barbara, we got a minute to the end of the hour. It's yours.
Wow, only a minute.
Only a minute.
In regards to Romney's potential sociopathology.
Yeah.
Doesn't it all really come down to a question of cause and effect? Excuse me.
Yeah, and that's the, you know, Justin Frank is suggesting it's Mormonism. I'm suggesting he was born that way.
Well, I mean, isn't that, aren't we merely wasting our time focusing our attentions on the cause of Romney's mentality by essentially engaging in character assassination, when what we should actually focus our attention on are the effects of such sociopathology on our politics, culture, and sociology?
I think if you don't define what you're facing, you're unprepared to face it.
But,
yeah, but we all need to understand that this is a man who will say anything to get what he wants. And if he becomes president of the United States, we have to be ready for a president who will say anything to get what he wants. And that's a characteristic that typically we haven't seen in presidents. That's a characteristic that you see in third world banana republic dictators. That's a characteristic that we saw, I'm not going to pull the old European 1930s canard out, but we've seen it before. Do we really want to see it again?
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, George Zimmerman's biggest mistake... Welcome back to the program. Tom Hartman here with you. George Zimmerman's biggest mistake was that he didn't pony up $47 to the National Rifle Association and buy insurance against going to jail if you shoot a black guy, if you're not a black guy, right? Yeah. I mean, the study's pretty conclusive. This Texas A&M did this fairly sweeping study of the Stand Your Ground, Shoot First laws and found that... to quote them, stand your ground, shoot first laws increase the chances of murder or manslaughter by lowering the expected costs associated with using lethal force. You can lower those costs even farther now by paying $47 to the NRA because they will give you insurance. They will defend you. They will pay for your defense in court if you shoot somebody and claim a stand your ground standing. The FBI looked into this and found that in 34% of cases involving a white shooter killing a black person, stand your ground was invoked and it was called a justifiable homicide. However, when the victim was white and the shooter was black, that stand your ground defense, instead of being successful 34% of the time, like when the killer was white, when the killer was black, it was only effective 3.3% of the time. Little bit of a problem there. Dr. John Lott is with us. JohnRLott.blogspot.com, his website. He's an economist and author of his latest book, The Bias Against Guns and More Guns, Less Crime. John, there's that. And let me just set up a second topic that I'd like to talk with you about. Indiana has passed a law. Mitch Daniels signed this into law in March, which followed a Supreme Court ruling in that state that ruled that somebody said the police, you know, kicked in their door illegally and he tried to fight back against them and he got busted for assaulting a police officer. And he said, that's wrong. I should be able to assault a police officer if he's not supposed to be in my house. The court said, no, you can't, you can't assault a police officer, period. And so the Indiana actually passed a law saying that if a police officer comes into your house illegally, you can kill them. And now the police officers are quite upset about this because, you know, it's not uncommon for them to kick down the wrong door. The street address is written down wrong. They get a 911 call. Somebody garbles the address. And now if they walk in, somebody can shoot them, blow them away, and it's perfectly legal in Indiana. John, do either of these laws make any sense to you?
Well, I'm not sure you quite explained the law correctly. What's saying is that the police officer have to identify themselves properly before they break in. I mean, sure, they may accidentally break down the wrong door, but just because they break down the wrong door isn't going to be enough to go and shoot them if they've properly identified themselves before they come in.
No, according to the Association of Prosecuting Attorneys in Washington, D.C., they say, and I quote, Indiana is the first U.S. state to specifically allow force against police officers. End of quote. In fact, they went on to say the president of the Indiana State Fraternal Order of Police said this is a recipe for disaster. It puts a bounty on our heads. He said that basically what the law says is that if a police officer is illegally breaking into your house, even if they identify themselves as a police officer, you can still kill them.
No. Part of illegally is that they don't identify themselves properly as police.
But that's not, you know, the law is not that narrowly defined. The law says that they actually have to have a warrant to break down your door.
Well, the issue is whether, basically, I think what it comes down to is whether the police have properly identified themselves before they break into the home. Police identify themselves correctly before they break in. You just can't go and blow away the police. You're not going to be able to check, in any case, whether or not they have the proper warrant.
Well, that's my point.
Before they break in. No, but that's the whole reason what's being said isn't correct. The basic point here is whether the police have correctly identified themselves. If the police officer breaks into your home, doesn't identify who they are, it's perfectly understandable why you don't know who's breaking in. You know, it could be some criminal who's breaking in who's going to be attacking you.
Right. So and now what's going to happen is that when the criminals break into your house, they're going to start yelling police before they kick in the door.
Well, that could be a problem.
And you can't shoot at them now.
Well, if you don't believe that they're the police, if you have reasonable reason to believe that they're not police, you could shoot them.
Well, bang, 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 police, crash! What do you think?
Right. Well, let me ask you this. Do you think the police should identify themselves before they break into somebody's home?
I do, but my understanding of this law is that it's not that narrowly defined.
All right. Well, I mean, obviously we've had a number of instances recently where some left-wingers have been going and getting SWAT teams to go after conservative bloggers around the country.
You know, I've heard stories of that, and apparently in one case it happened, and that left-winger, if you want to call him that, got arrested and is in jail. But this isn't some kind of weird national trend. I know you guys love to be victims, but sorry, that's not the stuff to make laws out of.
I didn't say it was.
It is. In fact, the laws are already there. It's against the law to call 911 under false pretenses.
Right. Well, anyway, my understanding is that there are four cases where that type
Well, then there's four people who will go to jail.
Okay, well,
so what? What does that have to do with this?
No, but the point is, do you want to make sure the police properly identify themselves before they go and break into somebody's home?
Well, maybe not. I mean, there may be cases where the police need to break in without identifying themselves, where they're trying to covertly break in or quietly break in, and I'm, you know...
Well, then you're going to have to change the laws on what's defined as legally able to go and break in or not. I mean,
well,
right,
you know,
now,
what if you come home and there's a...
...required to do that. So go and change that law. If you change that law in Indiana, so they don't have to identify themselves, then it's not going to be a problem under this because they won't be illegally breaking into people's homes.
So what if the police have a warrant to search 123 any street, and only the warrant says 132 any street, which happens to be your house and you're not home, and they break into the house, they don't smash anything or anything, they'll say the door's open. They walk in, they're looking around, you come into your house, their warrant is for a different house, or you know, right. Legally they're supposed to be in a different house, but they think they're in the right house, you think they're in the wrong house, you can now kill them. They haven't identified themselves, you weren't even there. You can walk in and just start shooting in Indiana. That's right?
I'm not sure about that.
I think this is just, you know, and I'm a guy who is kind of with Rand Paul typically on police matters. That is, you know, let's have some very serious Fourth Amendment and Fifth, Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendment protections against the armed and lethal force of government. And I'm surprised that conservatives don't take that position. It just boggles my mind.
Well,
they hate government until it has a gun in its hand. Then they love government. But in any case, I think I've said my piece on this. And John, so have you. What about this stand your ground laws? What do you have to say about the fact that 34%, according to the FBI, 34% of the time, white guy kills black guy, claims stand your ground, gets off. When black guy kills white guy, claims stand your ground, same kind of cases, only 3% do they get off. What's going on?
Right. Well, first of all, I wouldn't say that's according to the FBI. That's according to somebody who claims that they've looked through the FBI numbers. But it's not even the FBI numbers.
It's according. This is statistics compiled by the FBI.
No, but it's
get raw data, and then the person, somebody who's made this claim saying that they've used the FBI data, that's a lot different than saying that the FBI has gone and done a study. The FBI hasn't done a study.
Maybe they should.
Raw data, and so the question is, somebody looks at it, and they break it down in different ways on their own.
So have you broken it down in a different way? Do you see it as being racially balanced?
I haven't looked through that data yet, but my guess is I haven't seen any discussions about whether the differences are statistically significant or not. I mean, it'd be kind of important to determine that. It'd also be nice to go and determine whether or not there's something else that's going on. My own guess, having looked at lots of those types of studies in the past, is that if you accounted for income, for example, the entire difference would disappear. I mean, that's often what happens when people have looked at disparities.
Well, that's one of the problems that we have in this country, is that race and class very often go together because of institutional racism.
But if you include both at the same time, the entire result is driven by income and has nothing to do with
it. Dr. John Lott, John Arlott.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
JohnArlott.blogspot.com. John, thank you for dropping by today.
Thanks.
15 minutes past the hour. You know, this is one of the things that I find absolutely fascinating. There was a study 6-8 months ago. It came out. We talked about it on this program. In fact, we did a show. We did an hour segment on it about how you can tell a person's political persuasion by the programs they watch. That conservatives are more likely to watch, to be very, very heavy on watching cop shows. Right? They love watching cop shows. And conservatives are all about, you know, guns and cops. Wait a minute. I thought conservatives were afraid of government power. What is a more direct representation of government power than a government official with a gun and the authority to kill you? It's like conservatives are gung-ho for the death penalty, but they don't like the post office. I don't get this. Why is it that they think the government is so incompetent that it shouldn't be trusted with handling the delivery of mail? But if you happen to be on the wrong street corner at the wrong time and somebody misidentifies you as a killer, government should have the power to put you to death where you can never appeal your own innocence? Conservatives are, you know, they so hate the power of government when it comes to regulating the Koch brothers' factories and the mercury that they might put out, or the arsenic, or the whatever, you know, name the poison. Yes, we think CEOs should make more money and they should be allowed to pollute. Get rid of those nasty regulations. This is the conservative position. And yet, you know, because the government is bad. But yes, let the government put people to death. I don't understand it. You know, I'm experiencing cognitive dissonance. I don't get it. Rich in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Hey, Tom, love your show. Long-time listener, first-time caller. You know,
thanks.
I don't even know why they call themselves conservatives. There's nothing conservative about them. Like you said before me, you know, Reagan ran up the debt, the highest it was from Washington to Carter. And to your last caller, you know, I know he's not there, but that's a complete farce. You know, African Americans are 15 times more likely to be incarcerated than whites are. You know, when Chucklenut's brother Jeb Bush put the law in Florida, the Stand Your Ground law, 65 people have walked on that law. Not one person has been prosecuted. Are you telling me that unequivocally every single person, every black person who's in prison is there because they committed a crime that they should legitimately be there? You know, it makes about as much sense as a screen door on a submarine, Tom. You know,
yeah.
I don't know how you can talk to some of these guys, but especially that one guy who's always trying to shout you down without pulling your hair out.
Yesterday, yeah.
These people are completely narcissists, selfish whores who give care nothing about people but themselves, the person in the mirror. You were talking earlier about, we don't know if when Governor Etch-a-Sketch gets in, what he'll do. You know what? You don't even, you know, like you said, you don't even have to look at The guy who shovels your walk or makes cookies, the serial killers. Oh, he was a nice guy. He cleaned my walk for and he made cookies for the lady next door. And then he went and, you know, put...
Yeah, that was the John Wayne Gacy story, yeah.
The paneling. Yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, you don't even have to... It's the same mentality, even if you're not a serial killer. The fact that what you'll do and say, you'll step on everybody and anything and that's in your way to basically further your cause. And then, you know, and then damn, be damn everybody else, you know? It's sickening. It's
yeah.
just absolutely
and, well,
sickening.
It's, and where did conservative come out of all of this? Rich, thank you for your call. And you're absolutely right about your statistics. And as I've said many times in this program, and we just need to acknowledge it and then do something about it, we do not have one criminal justice system in this country. We have at least two, one for average working people and poor people, and one for rich and powerful people, and arguably maybe a third one for really rich and powerful people. Desmond in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Desmond, what's up?
Hello, Tom, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I would have commented on the sociopath issue, but I happened to tune in just as John Lott was speaking, and I went to the website to see what he's saying. And I'm not even going to comment on what he said. I just want to make the readership, the listening aware of a case that's taking place in New York City.
Okay.
4 months ago, there was a black young man, 18 years old, who was being chased by the street narcotics unit. And he went into his house. Now, his house has surveillance cameras. He was seen walking into his house in a relaxed manner.
Mm-hmm.
The street narcotics unit came into the house, and they broke the door in. They came into the house with guns drawn. They pushed people in the house aside, and they went into upstairs into the house and saw the young man in the bathroom. One officer, Officer Hasty, that's his name, H-A-S-T-E, assumed that the young man had a gun and shot him. The youth subsequently died.
Yeah.
Officer Hasty is on trial, I believe, for second and third degree manslaughter now, which is odd in New York City.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually the appropriate outcome if, you know, that there would be a trial. There would be a serious investigation, and if it looks like the police officer used excessive force, then...
Used excessive force. But even if that were the case, once this young man was inside his house, constitutionally, if he had a gun, he was within his rights. The police had no warrant. They may have shouted that they were the police.
Well, I believe that the police have the right to pursue you into your home if they have probable cause to believe that you have or are in the act of committing a crime.
But their insistence was that he had a gun.
Uh-huh.
He was not in the process of committing a crime. Uh-huh. Their allegation was that he had a firearm. And therefore,
while outside the house.
Right. But he was worthy of being pursued and with full use of force once they got within a reasonable distance of him.
You know, Desmond, what this illustrates is the exact same thing that I think these stats on the stand your ground, shoot first laws do, which is that there's a different set of justice rules in the United States for white people and black people. And it's another thing that we need to be confronting and calling out. Racism is still alive and well. Desmond, thank you for the call. This is very, very troubling. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
How do we fix this in the United States, particularly in the face of a Republican Party that wants to use it to divide us? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And have we gone nuts as a nation? Have we just gone insane? I mean, is that what's going on here? You've got the National Rifle Association, basically the trade representative for the weapons industry in the United States, and Walmart, which recently I understand left ALEC, but back when they were with the American Legislative Exchange Council, which was founded back in the 1970s by Paul Weyrich, the guy who said, I don't want everybody to vote. Among the other laws that ALEC has gotten passed, this Koch brothers funded ALEC has gotten passed, in addition to, no, you can't vote, sorry. Oh, you're as in the case of Think Progress went to Wisconsin, they've got one on their homepage at thinkprogress.org. So you're a 92-year-old lady who doesn't see very well. You can't vote. You can't get a driver's license. Sorry. Besides that, you're on Social Security. You might vote like a Democrat. I mean, you're not going to vote for Paul Ryan. He wants to privatize your Medicare. Are you kidding? We can't let you vote. So anyhow, they're all about that. But they're also about, let's pass some laws that let people shoot each other without going to jail. Especially they'll let white people shoot black people. Isn't that special? Have we gone nuts? That we've got people running around saying, oh, yeah, my gun is more important than your life. And what happened to the conservative notion that we should be concerned about the authority of the power of government? Except when it's the police or the army. Although, you know, it does get flipped around in Indiana, and this is the thing. I don't understand how conservatives are even dealing with this, that in Indiana they've made it legal to shoot cops. I don't agree with it. I think it's wrong. Police officers do really, really, really tough work. I've never been a police officer. I was licensed as a private detective for 2 years. I've hung out with a lot of PIs. I went through the Georgia Police Academy. I have a certificate. I've met a lot of cops and people on their way to being cops when I went through the Georgia Police Academy. And I can tell you that there are some people who are there because they just can't wait to beat the bejesus out of somebody. And there's a lot of people who are there because they're looking for a decent job and they want to serve their community. And the people in the latter category are underpaid, and the people in the former category would do it for almost anything, and therefore there needs to be a stronger filter to keep them out. But that's almost a whole completely separate argument. I just, you know, it's bizarre. Jeff in Canton, Michigan. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey. It's funny this group of people who call themselves conservatives and concerned about the power and authority of government have essentially returned to what one of the primary arguments of our founding fathers was, and objections of our founding fathers, was a writ of assistance, authority given to somebody without a check on that authority, that the customs officials would use this writ to do all kinds of things against merchants and people in the community. Right. And the funny thing about it is that this writ of assistance has now matriculated down to the individual, where an individual has been given a writ of assistance to fire a gun in suspicion. And that is fundamentally against the founding of this nation.
Yeah. Now, just to translate this into full-blown English for our listeners who don't know what you're talking about, back in the 1770s and for 100 years before that, the customs officers who worked for the crown, if they thought that you were smuggling or something like that, they had the authority to come into your home, to go through your papers, in addition, I mean, the reason why we have the Third Amendment, which pretty much nobody even knows what it is, but, you know, they had the authority to come in and say, oh, you know, that bedroom in your house, that now is where the soldiers are going to sleep, or three of our soldiers are going to sleep there. And the one, your next-door neighbor, three soldiers are going to, you know, it's called quartering. They could commandeer your house and put soldiers in there. And the writ of assistance is basically the conveyance of the authority to trash whatever rights you may have by the government, usually on behalf of economic interests. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And essentially what the objection or the check on the writ of assistance was the warrant. The warrant was essentially a mini trial to justify the authority for the action.
Right.
And that's why we value the warrant so much.
Essentially, yes. Thus the Fourth Amendment.
Yes, exactly. Protection of persons, you know, and the warrant has to describe the place to be searched, the person, so forth and so on. And this is why we value this in this country. And the thing about the writ of assistance, it was so objectionable to this country and so objectionable to the modern lifestyle, the modern government, is that it was perceived to be a form of tyranny.
Yes.
And when you give that to somebody, when you license somebody with that, without having to have their power checked, and you give them an arm, a gun, you have the most dangerous scenario, the most dangerous form of tyranny that you could possibly hope to have. You've emboldened somebody with an authority that's unchecked, that only needs suspicion or the most limited probable cause to act. And for these people that are so constitutionally bound and so familiar with the Founding Fathers, that they could side with this idea of the writ of assistance is absurd.
Yeah. In fact, here, from the Declaration of Independence, Jefferson says, you know, a reasonable, such has been the patient. Okay. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and provide new guards for their future security. And, you know, he starts out by saying, you know, we basically have to explain why. And so he goes through this list. For quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them by a mock trial from punishment for any murders which they should commit on the inhabitants of the state, for cutting off our trade with other parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent, for depriving us in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury, for abolishing the free system of English laws in a neighboring province, thereby establishing an arbitrary government and enlarging its boundaries so as to render it at once an example and fit instrument for introducing the same absolute rule into these colonies, for taking away our charters, abolishing our most valuable laws, and altering fundamentally the forms of our governments, for suspending our own legislatures. This is starting to sound like what Rick Scott is all about in Michigan. For suspending our own legislatures and declaring themselves invested with power to legislate for us in all cases whatsoever. So anyhow, the Fourth Amendment very simply says the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. One sentence, one straightforward thing. And Jeff, you're absolutely right in your history of it. Thank you. Very, very well said. You wanted to add something?
Pardon me?
Okay.
Yeah, I just wanted to add. You know, at least the customs officials weren't armed against their own civilians. In other words, when you move this from government to citizen, that's one thing. But when you move it from individual to individual, it becomes chaotic.
Yes. And yes. This is anarchy in the most negative sense. Well said, Jeff. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call, Jim in Nanjimoy, North Dakota.
No, Maryland.
Maryland. Oh, MD.
I'm just down the Potomac from you, Tom.
Say that again?
And I'd like to get a couple points across, if you wouldn't cut me off. Number one, I've looked through all my NRA membership information. I am a member, and I can't find anything in there that they will represent me legally if I kill somebody.
This is brand new. This is brand new. Here's what's covered. You can find it on their website, and I'll read it. I'll read you from their website. What's covered? Provides coverage up to the limits selected for criminal and civil defense costs. Cost of civil suit defense is provided in addition to the limit of liability for bodily injury and property damage. Criminal defense reimbursement is provided for alleged criminal actions involving self-defense when you are acquitted of such criminal charges or the charges are dropped. The basic liability plan costs either $47 or $67 annually for coverage up to $100,000 or $250,000, respectively.
Okay. Well, thanks for bringing that to my attention. I'll pay the extra $12 a year to get that, I imagine.
$47 a year is the cost. Sean in Laredo, Texas. A minute to the break. Sean, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom? I just wanted to talk about what you're talking about right now. Earlier you're talking about sociopaths, and now you're talking about conservatives and how their kind of thinking is warped. But it's warped by the media, and I mean, the media is warped by these sociopaths. They work as a team. I mean, it's not just one person. They've got friends.
Yeah. Well, the media has become a for-profit institution, and there used to be a little island within the media called News that was not a for-profit institution. It was a public service institution. That has become corrupted, and so now it's all for-profit, and for-profit is by definition sociopathic.
Exactly. And so all these guys are working together, and they're all on the same team, and they split it up. They're real smart. They split it up into, I'm a Republican. I'm a Democrat. Well, I mean, these people are getting their money from the same places. Everybody's on the same team, but
in some cases, you will find some glaring exceptions to that, Sean. And I would refer you to people like Bernie Sanders or Sherrod Brown or Dennis Kucinich. We'll be right back. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, speaking of people getting their money and where they're getting it, I got to tell you what happened before the Senate Banking Committee today. It's going to explode your head. Right. Cheney's got a gun? Oh, Cheney. Okay. It sounded like Cheney. I thought, that's a gulp. Ellen. This Talk Radio News Service report is brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Where are you, Ellen? In New York City?
I just got to New York. It's my brother Michael Ratner's birthday today. So,
well, will you please wish him a happy birthday from me?
Next year's a big one for him.
Yeah, Michael Ratner is one of my heroes. He was one of our Conversations with Great Minds conversations, which you can see over at conversationswithgreatminds.com. Brilliant fellow, your brother. So,
well,
what's going on
you.
In the news?
It was hard being a not-so-brilliant younger sister.
Well, you're pretty brilliant, too, Ellen.
Not like he is. Okay, so I guess the big news today is that J.P. Morgan CEO Jamie Dimon testified before the Senate Banking Committee. He said that his chief investment officer, that I guess it's called a CIO, not CIA, said that he tried to reduce risk in the year 2012, but it fell under the radar screen. He was asked by Senator Corker, Republican of Tennessee, whether the regulating regime has made the system safer. He answered he did not know. Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey asked him whether was this gambling. He said no. He said, now this is fascinating, and Tom, you read a lot more financial information than I do. He said no taxpayer or client money was lost. Well, I don't know how you lose $2 billion and no client money is lost.
Well, it would have been the money that ultimately would have been the stockholders of J.P. Morgan Chase.
Of course.
Yeah,
but isn't that a client, too? I guess not.
No, they're not. They're stockholders. But here's what I found really interesting about this. As you know, Senator Crapo, is that how it's said? Crapo. He said, he asked the question, this really, really piercing, just right to the bone. I mean, here's a guy who took, billions of dollars in bailout money and was gambling and helped bring down the whole financial system. He asked him the really tough question, what should the function of the regulators be? Now, that caused me to say, well, who does Crapo get his money from? You know who Senator Mike Crapo's number one campaign contributor was in the election cycle 2007 to 2012?
Not guessing.
J.P. Morgan Chase and Company, number one. And so then Senator Bob Corker says, Mr. Dimon, what would happen if you didn't have the ability to hedge risks in a way that makes sense? Because Dimon says, we lost that money trying to hedge risks. And, of course, Dimon goes, thank you so much for that question, Senator. That was very nice. Look up Senator Bob Corker over at OpenSecrets.org. And his number one contributor was Goldman Sachs. His number two contributor, guess who?
J.P.
Morgan. Yes.
That is wild. I didn't do that kind of research. I will next time.
This is like, you get busted for a traffic ticket and you go into court or for a crime and you go into court and the judge and the prosecutor are people who are your employees, right? Or they're your brother and sister-in-law or something like that. I mean, it's just, enough of my rant.
Speaking of money, the National Journal runs this thing called Influence Alley. And one of their enterprising reporters looked up in the final push to get the president's health care plan the Americans Health Insurance Plans, AHIP, gave the Chamber of Congress $16.2 million. But the way he figured this out is he looked into the IRS files, and the chamber reported all of this $86.2 million 1 year from undisclosed groups. But they also know that it was very close to what AHIP supposedly gave away but didn't tell where they were getting it.
Right. AHIP is the lobbying group for the insurance industry, the for-profit insurance industry.
The Americans Health Insurance Plan is what it's called. Right. The total amount, according to National Journal, that they have figured out that was given just by that one group on the health care issue was $120.4 million.
Wow. Well, that's, you know, with 30 million new customers, they're going to make easily $120 billion over the next decade.
Right.
So, you know, invest a dollar, make a thousand. Not bad.
So, okay. So that was quite shocking. Since we seem to be on a theme of the economy today, Douglas Elmendorf from Congressional Budget Office said there's still a lot of pain that's going to be coming. He said that the problem with elevated unemployment is that when people are off the unemployment or off in being employed, their skills deteriorate. It's harder for them to re-enter the workforce. This is going to be a serious economic problem, and that the loss of household wealth was a major problem. He considered a great drag on the economy.
Yeah.
He also said that a debt was weighing on household spending. Not terribly surprising. Also, Mary Miller, again going on our economic theme today, Undersecretary of Treasury for Domestic Finance, said that they had 18,000 public comments about restricting banks from making speculative investments.
Amazing. 18,000. And I'm guessing virtually all of them were saying, stop the banks from doing that, but you're not going to hear that from
That's exactly what happened.
Right, but you're not going to hear that from Senators Crapo or what's his name?
Why don't we just call them Corker. Senators J.P. Morgan?
Yeah, I think so. You know, one of the chapters in my book, Rebooting the American Dream, is titled, Make Congressmen Wear NASCAR Patches.
Right.
You know, I mean, you know, Corker and Crapo should have J.P. Morgan embroidered on their jackets. So, anyway.
Exactly.
You got other news?
I have other news. Yes. Syria. Russia is accusing the United States of providing weapons to the opposition. Today, Jake Carney said that everybody should stop providing weapons. The United States is not providing weapons to the opposition. This, again, is Mr. Putin doing his thing.
Right. Okay. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. This Talk Radio, I need to get this in here for you, Ellen. This Talk Radio News, and thank you, Ellen, very much.
Thank you.
This Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the German Embassy, which wants you to know that Germany supports the European strategy to strengthen the euro through fiscal stability, solidarity, and growth. You can learn more online at germany.info. Coming up next, the F word. Yep, we're going to use it. We're going to talk about it. That word that was invented by Mussolini. What's going on in the United States right now with regard to the F word? Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, they're back. Yep, they're back. You know, in the economic turmoil of the 1930s, something called fascism swept across Europe, took a hold in Germany and Italy, and eventually threw the entire planet into a world war. Fascism is the merging of government and corporate interests. Very simple, very straightforward, with a tinge of nationalism and a little bit of racism thrown in to keep the population in line and united against a perceived enemy, a them, an other. As Mussolini was dissolving parliament in 1938 and setting up his Camera di Fasci della Corporazione, I don't know. I can't speak Italian, but close enough. The Chamber of Fascist Corporations is what it would be called in English. Italian philosopher Giovanni Gentile argued that fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it hands government off to corporations. So in 1944, the vice president of the United States at that time, Henry Wallace, Franklin Roosevelt's VP in 1944, was asked by the New York Times, what about fascists in America? And in answer to that question, he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about the dangers of fascism and the threat that fascists posed to the United States. He wrote, fascism, this is the vice president of the United States speaking, in 1944. Fascism is a worldwide disease. Its greatest threat to the United States will come after the war within the United States itself. Another fascist danger is represented by those who pay lip service to democracy and the common welfare. In their insatiable greed for money and the power which money gives, do not hesitate surreptitiously to evade the laws designed to safeguard the public from monopolistic extortion. Despite the warnings by Vice President Henry Wallace, and he genuinely believed at that time that the American system government was strong enough to avoid becoming fascistic, to avoid becoming a corporate estate. At that time, it was pretty much unheard of that a CEO would run for political office. In Wallace's view, politicians knew that their obligation was to represent we the people and protect us from the corporate cartels. Wallace continued in his article for the New York Times. Happily, he wrote, it can be said that as yet, fascism has not captured a predominant place in the outlook of any American section, class, or religion. It may be encountered in Wall Street, Main Street, or Tobacco Road. Some even suspect that they can detect incipient traces of it along the Potomac. But if we put our trust in the common sense of common men, and with malice toward none and charity for all, go forward on the great adventure of making political, economic, and social democracy a practical reality, we shall not fail. A year later, the fascists in Europe were defeated by Henry Wallace and Franklin Roosevelt, among others. And the fascists in America were banished to the political wilderness as Roosevelt's New Deal revolution really took hold. But today, four generations later, the fascists are back. And we need to revisit a poignant warning that Vice President Wallace had for us in 1944 when he wrote for the New York Times, American fascism will not be really dangerous until there is a purposeful coalition among the cartelists, the deliberate poisoners of public information, and those who stand for the KKK type of demagoguery. End of quote. This fascist coalition of corporate cartels, an entire television network devoted to disinformation and right-wing demagoguery, is stronger today in America than ever before. We now have an open corporatist. Corporations are people, my friend! An open corporatist, Mitt Romney, running for the highest office in the land. Romney fits Wallace's description of a fascist perfectly. He's a man who pays lip service to democracy and the common welfare, but in his insatiable greed evades laws that protect the common welfare by stealing pensions from and then laying off thousands of American workers and closing American factories just to make hundreds of millions of dollars as head of the pirate equity firm Bain Capital. In other corporatists, fascists, from banksters to oil barons to corporate front groups like the U.S. Chamber of Commerce pledging to spend over $1 billion to make sure their front man is elected in November, what would you call that? Well, Vice President Wallace in his New York Times op-ed defines the American fascists this way. Quote, they claim to be super patriots, but they would destroy every liberty guaranteed by the Constitution. They demand free enterprise, but they are the spokesman for monopoly and vested interest. Their final objective, toward which all their deceit is directed, is to capture political power so that using the power of the state and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the common man in eternal subjection. End of quote from the Vice President of the United States in 1944. And the corporate cartel now has the help of those who Wallace called the deliberate poisoners of public information, his phrase. The corporatist media outlets on cable news, led by Fox so-called News, along with the corporatist agents in the right-wing blogosphere and right-wing talk radio. Wallace wrote, "The American fascists are most easily recognized by their deliberate perversion of truth and fact. Their newspapers and propaganda carefully cultivate every fissure of disunity, every crack in the common front against fascism. They use every opportunity to impugn democracy." And this strategy, by the way, the Vice President Wallace identified in 1944, continues with today's purveyors of hate, who appear regularly on these same corporatist media outlets. They include the Islamophobes, the religious zealots who rail against gays, and the economic elites who try to pit working Americans against each other, the private worker against the public worker, the union worker against the non-union worker, the male worker against the female worker. They're all about making a split, divide and conquer. Quote Scott Walker. So nearly 70 years after the vice president's warning, after Vice President Henry Wallace's warning, we now know that it can happen here, that we too can be taken over by fascism. And to some extent, we already have been. And considering what fascism did to the world the last time it took power, we should all be concerned about the next few years in America. And the very real challenges we face as we try to reclaim our democracy and our economy. This is arguably the most high-stakes struggle for American democracy that we have seen since the founding of the Republic. I realize we fought a civil war. We fought a couple of world wars. The Civil War was probably a bigger one. Well, not probably. Certainly was. You had people killing their own brothers. But is there anybody alive today who can remember a time when Americans were so polarized? This high-stakes struggle to preserve American democracy against the forces of fascism, it begins today. And you have to show up and participate. Right. Movement politics is what makes all these things work. We need to get involved. It's not enough to just sit around. It's not enough to just vote. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So I'm calling it out. I'm calling it fascism. When you have one of the biggest, most wealthy banksters in the United States running for the presidency, what do you call it? Okay, Giovanni Gentile was actually the author, but Mussolini took credit for it. The Encyclopedia Italiano, the Italian Encyclopedia back in the 1930s, I think it was 37 or 38. Fascism should more appropriately be called corporatism because it is the merger of corporation and state. Are we there yet? I just got an email a little bit ago from a friend of mine in Oregon listing the 22 now, up from 14, state representatives and state senators who are members of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC. This is an organization where lobbyists and representatives of large corporations and representing the interests of billionaires sit down 50-50, one-to-one, in a room with state representatives and state senators from states all over the country, 500 lobbyists, 500 senators and state representatives, and they all have an equal vote on writing laws that when they're done, and if there's a majority vote in ALEC, which could be all the lobbyists and one paid-off schlub, when they're done, those laws, if they get a majority vote in ALEC, those laws are handed off to the Republicans, largely Republican. There's a couple of Democrats who are members of ALEC, but they're few and far between. Handed off to them to take back to their state and, oh, here's a stand your ground, shoot first law. Oh, here's a voter ID law. Oh, here's a law that makes it harder to sue if you're injured by, fill in the blank. Oh, here's a law that says that you can't regulate the emissions coming from smokestacks. Here's a law that makes it more profitable to outsource your jobs to India or China or Vietnam or wherever it may be. You tell me we're not there already? Or getting there? Douglas in Aurora, Colorado. Hey, Douglas.
Hi, Tom. I appreciate your show, and I appreciate your intelligence.
Thank you. What do you see as a solution for this?
Actually, I've been working for the last year on a solution, and it's a simple one. And President Jefferson and President Madison both talked about this 200 years ago. Madison said, knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and the people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with the power which knowledge gives.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, and for the last 236 years, there's never been a single place in the country where people could go and study the issues and study accurate information on the issues. And so I've structured a website to do this.
Okay.
And it will tell about the first 26 major issues, and it will tell every aspect of every issue, and it will tell the pros and the cons and who's lying about it and the history of the issue and where it's been solved in other countries. And if we make a mistake in the issue, there'll be a place for people to come in and correct what we have missed. And all it will take is for the people to get behind it, because it's going to take a lot of money to do this. It'll take hundreds of researchers to assemble all the best research on every major topic, military spending, health.
So, Douglas, I got a bunch of other people who want to get in here. What's the website?
StrikingTheTruth.com.
Okay, great. Thank you. I wish you the very best. It sounds like a great project. Let me just very quickly, Thomas Jefferson, 1800, a letter to Jeremiah Moore. I may further say that I have not observed man's honesty to increase with their riches. And this in a letter to Edward Carrington in 1787. I am convinced that those societies as the Indians, which live without government, enjoy in their general mass an infinitely greater degree of happiness than those who live under European governments. Among the Indians, public opinion is the place of law and restrains morals as powerfully as laws ever did anywhere. Among the Europeans, under pretense of governing, they have divided their nations into two classes, wolves and sheep. I do not exaggerate. Experience declares that man is the only animal which devours his own kind, for I can apply no milder term to the governments of Europe and to the general prey of the rich upon the poor. Thomas Jefferson, founder of our nation. Dominic in Albany. Hey, Dominic.
Hey, how are you? Tom, you are spot on. You know, I'm listening to this conversation, and to equate corporatism to fascism is an absolute certainty. That's exactly where we're headed. We are, if we're not already there.
How can an America which has this history, which learned these lessons, which stood up against the fascists in World War II, how can an America like that nominate for the office of President of the United States a man who is a bankster, who made his living, you know, moving money around and tearing down businesses, stripping them, gutting them, throwing people out of work? I mean, I don't understand it.
It's not an overnight
and a man who says corporations are people, my friends.
Yeah, exactly. And it's not an overnight process. What we're witnessing is, if you just look at our media system owned by these huge moguls, these billionaires who control all the information disseminated throughout the country, if it's not fitting what their policies and mindset and direction is, it doesn't reach the people.
Yeah. But to some extent, I think we may be the exception that proves the rule, actually. And in fact, I think that's probably the case. Dominic, thank you. Very well said. Experience declares the man is the only animal which devours his own kind, for I can apply no milder term to the general prey of the rich upon the poor. Thomas Jefferson, 1787.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That was the year our Constitution was written. Get that? That's amazing. Okay, back to the F word right after this. Yep, it's the good, the bad, and the very, very agathocacologiciously ugly. Brought to you by the Organic Wine Company at ecowine.com. The good. Workers at Eleftheroptera. Eleftheroptera, I'm sure I'm mangling that, was Greece's second largest newspaper, founded after the fall of the military dictatorship in 1974. The left-wing newspaper featured strong independent reporting and fought against corruption in government, among other causes. Well, with the collapse of the Greek economy, the paper was forced to shut down. But now, about 120 former workers at the paper have brought it back to life and have managed to publish special editions of the newspaper. They have already produced two editions, and a third is on the way before the Greek general election rerun. Hopefully the workers at Eleftheroptera will be able to keep the paper alive so that there continues to be a strong independent voice for democracy in Greece. The bad. The NRA. The NRA is now offering insurance to cover members should they face a legal battle as a result of shooting someone in so-called self-defense. Or in other words, the NRA is now giving its members full protection when they decide to invoke stand your ground, shoot first laws. The insurance plan provides coverage for criminal and civil defense costs and also offers criminal defense reimbursement. And NRA members can get this coverage for low prices at just $47 to $67 a year. The NRA was instrumental in pushing stand your ground, shoot first laws across America, and now it appears they've given their gun-toting members who commit murders under these laws a get-out-of-jail-free card, too. And the very, very ugly Burger King. In America, 17% of children and adolescents are obese, while nearly a third of all adults in the country are also obese. In other words, we have an obesity epidemic in our country, and instead of working to fight that epidemic, Burger King is working to make Americans even fatter. Fast food chain has released a bacon sundae. That's right, an ice cream sundae laced with bacon bits and bacon strips. With over 500 calories and 18 grams of fat, Burger King's bacon sundae is one heck of an artery clogger. Even McDonald's has added more nutritious and healthier options to its menu. But not Burger King. They're throwing more unhealthy food at Americans and promoting obesity in an already grossly overweight country. And that is very, very ugly. It's pretty mind-bogglingly ugly. Tim, in Syracuse, New York. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind today?
I was going to say that 9 years before Wallace, Sinclair Lewis said that when fascism comes to the United States, it will come wrapped in a flag and carrying a cross.
Yes, he said that in his book, It Can't Happen Here.
And I think when you say, like, what is it that we can do to try to stem this tide? The Democrats have to get better at their messaging. You know, Frank Luntz is far as, the guy's a good wordsmith. He certainly knows how to twist a phrase. And I think until the Democrats start getting their message out there better, because look at how the Republicans get away with calling Obama a socialist or a Nazi even, and it sticks. But when we do it, we don't have the same effect.
Right. Yeah. It's, by and large, we don't do it. And that's one of the things. I mean, you can tune in to conservative talk radio all across this country any day of the week and hear hundreds of times, you know, or dozens of times in your local town, Obama called a socialist and Democrats referred to as, you know, whatever. You will very, very rarely, and I think, you know, to your point, Tim, and thank you for the call and for making it, you will very, very rarely hear Mitt Romney called a fascist. Or the Republican Party, or the Republican agenda, the whole corporatist agenda, the whole privatize everything agenda, the whole let's turn America into a nation of, by, and for we the corporations. Kevin in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to let you know that for about the past 15, 20 minutes, Comcast has been blacking out free speech TV.
No, that problem is actually happening right here in our studio. We have this contraption called a TriCaster that generates our video stream, and it has been crashing, and Jim has been on the phone to the manufacturer. If you know anybody at TriCaster, let them know that we're having a problem.
I'm afraid that's
on our end. It's not Comcast. Sorry.
I just tuned in when you were talking about, you know, what's it going to take to have things change, you know, and I want to try to keep this short and to the point without getting excited, but I think it's been about 100 years since a great man said that things are going to have to get much worse before they get better. And that man was Vladimir Lenin. And I hope to God, and I pray to God, that we don't have to learn the lessons that the Romanovs learned to get this country straightened out. And I appreciate you letting me tell you that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. The Romanovs, of course, the Russian royal family who were executed by the peasants. I don't see any peasant executions coming, but I would like to see an awakening. Stephen in Taos, New Mexico. Hey, Stephen.
Well, hi, Tom. How's Louise?
She is, chemo is no fun at all, but she's going to be fine.
I'm happy to hear that. We're praying for her.
Thank you.
I want to congratulate you on your speech. I'd like to see you make a transcript of it, make it available on your website.
We'll put it up on, assuming that our TriCaster didn't totally crash and lose it. We will put it up on YouTube.
Yeah. Well done. And I agree with the previous caller, progressives, Democrats are failing in their message to the American people. American people are by and large dumbed down and uninformed by a media that no longer serves their interests but serves the interests of their corporate masters, and they're not getting the message. This is classic fascism.
You know, I was sitting in a bar that's across the street from the marina where Louise and I live, and talking with some people who live on the water. It's quite a community of it's a lot of retired people, a lot of retired military, actually a lot of Navy guys, and a lot of young people there, because it's inexpensive housing for Washington D.C. and it's tight, but it's inexpensive. And this one guy, he's like, I don't want the government deciding, what they're going to pay for and what they're not going to pay for with regard to health care. It shouldn't be the government's job. And I said, oh, you want Stephen Hemsley to decide that? He's like, who's he? Oh, he's a guy who made $1 billion telling people that he wouldn't pay for their, liver transplants and things. And he's like, well, it's the free market. And I'm like, no, it's not the free market. It's a giant health insurance company. And do you really want to turn, your fate over to a giant bank, basically? Health insurance companies are banks. And he's like, well, it's not a bank. They don't give vaccinations. And eventually you get to the point where these people, it suddenly dawns on them that it's not a choice between government providing a service, whether it's healthcare or whether it's electricity or whether it's, clean water or fire departments or police or whatever, between government providing it or freedom, but that it's a choice between government providing it or a corporation providing it in an environment that has increasingly become fascistically monopolistic, the monopoly that Henry Wallace talked about in that letter to the New York Times, where he,
absolutely.
And that's where we're at, and that's where we've come, and it's making me crazy. We need to be talking about it. Thank you, Stephen, very much for the call. I appreciate it. Lemoyne, am I pronouncing that right, in Albuquerque?
That's correct.
Hey,
hi, Tom.
Thanks for calling. What's up?
Well, I want to say we have a anti-corporate personhood, money is not speech resolution in the city council. So anybody in Albuquerque, ask them to contact their counselor.
Great.
This week or Monday, because they're going to hear it on Monday, or come to the city council meeting on Monday.
Okay. You got
resolution.
It.
I wanted to talk to you about a part of that is an argument against corporate personhood based on equal protection.
Okay.
It says the
resolution says something like, whereas granting human rights to corporations endows the owners and operators of corporations with a second, potentially more powerful set of human rights, the any doctrine of corporate personhood inherently violates equal protection.
Yes, the 14th Amendment. And ironically, it's the 14th Amendment, which says no person shall be denied equal protection under the law, that is has been used by the Supreme Court since the 1870s, 1880s, to create this doctrine that corporations should have rights, because they said, because it says any person, it doesn't say any natural person, and corporations under law are considered artificial persons. And so the Supreme Court has interpreted, you know, corporations as persons too. But that is absolutely great. Congratulations and to all of our listeners on KABQ or however in Albuquerque you may be hearing or seeing this program. Get down to the city council next week. Good on you, Lemoyne. Thank you very much for sharing the story with us. Rick in St. Louis. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, how's it going today?
Good.
You were talking about fascism and everything, and I've been watching a couple of old movies, Meet John Doe and A Face in the Crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I swear to you, A Face in the Crowd is Rush Limbaugh all day long, him and Glenn Beck and all the right-wingers, and, you know, the character that Andy Griffin plays.
Uh-huh.
And as far as Meet John Doe, wow, all the newspaper guys and the big oil guys who are propping up Gary Cooper's character to go ahead and run for office or whatnot.
Right.
Their spokesman. It's the exact same thing that Mitt Romney and the Republican Party is doing, especially with Sarah Palin. You know, I mean, they just pick someone,
huh,
you know, who's clearly unqualified.
Right.
And it's wrong with it. And it just kills me that history is repeating itself, and now as it's repeating itself, we have exactly how it's going to be laid out, how it's going to be laid out, played out.
Yeah. Well, back in the 40s, they understood this stuff. I mean, Henry Wallace, the Vice President of the United States, was writing about it in the New York Times. Meet John Doe, Face in the Crowd. I've heard of both of these movies. I have not seen either one. Rick, you just put them on my list. I wrote them down. Thank you for the call, and thank you for the heads up. I don't watch that many movies, but old movies, cool.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So is it time to declare that America is confronting the F word? Or have I gone over the edge here? Well, it is if we show up, right? It's a really simple formula. Devon in Blacksburg, Virginia. You want to speak to that, don't you?
Indeed I do, Tom. Good on you for being part of the
station. Devon, your phone is so badly distorting your voice, I can't understand what you're saying.
Better? Can you hear me now, Tom?
Yes. Now,
okay,
now I can hear you clearly.
Awesome. Good on you. You give honor to the Fourth Estate.
Thank you.
You may want to go back and watch an old movie that I saw last night, Little Big Man. Boy, are there some profound...
I'm making a list here. Meet John Doe, Face in the Crowd, Little Big Man.
Little Big Man with Dustin Hoffman. A lot of lessons there about Mother Earth and...
Oh, yeah. That's the one about... It's about Native Americans. It's...
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a vague recollection of having seen that back in the 70s, but...
Yeah. Watch it again. It'll blow your mind.
Okay.
Timeless. So things do get better when you get active. About a year ago or so, you put me on the air about the Radford Army Ammunition Plant, and things are changing. Things are getting better.
Good.
The Sierra Club, which is a Democratic organization, although they do have a black eye at this point in some places. On June 20th at the Sierra Club New River Valley Group meeting, I'll be presenting on the open burning ground at the Radford Arsenal. Starts at 7 p.m. at Lucy Monroe's Coffee Shop in Christiansburg. Everyone's welcome. You
Great.
Don't have to be a Sierra Club member. And, you know, I was discouraged at one point, but there was something you used to say, like, first they fight you, then they... How's it go?
Yeah, it was Mahatma Gandhi actually said it. He said, you know, first they I don't want to get it wrong. It's something like first they ridicule you, then they – no, first they ignore you, then they ridicule you, then they fight you, then you win.
Right
as
on.
As I recall. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. And things are changing. People are paying attention. Elected officials are starting to listen. So it's true. Just you know, get out there, get active, get involved, and speak up.
Yeah.
Because we are the government, you
yes.
know?
Yeah, it's called
that's the way it's supposed to work.
Yep, the first three words of the Constitution, we the people. Very well said. Devon, thank you very much, and keep up the great work. Don in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Don, what's up?
Hey, Tom, for the frothing at the mouth, true-believing teabaggers,
mm-hmm.
I refer them as the Nutsies, N-U-T-S-I-E-S.
Well, you know, let's be careful here because you know, I know some tea partiers, and I mean, some of them are my neighbors, and
well,
they're misinformed. You know, this is the problem. They watch Fox News all day long, and they live in this parallel universe. I think though, instead of kicking them, we need to be reaching out to them and waking them up.
There's some that have to be kicked, though. There's some that will
well,
never change.
Well, the ones who are funding them, perhaps. I mean, you know, Dick Armey, you know, multimillionaire lobbyist here in D.C., and most of these Tea Partiers don't realize that he's the, you know, the puppet master and the Koch brothers, you know, pouring all his money in. But
that's like saying we did in the Civil War, we didn't have to fight the Southern whites that were just being used.
Yeah, you know, and the whites would say that the North, or the, excuse me, the Southerners would say that the people in the North were being used in the interest of the banks. But that, you know, I don't want to I'm not taking either position. I don't want to relitigate the Civil War. I think that, though, when we label people, this is the reason why I was reluctant to do a segment on the F word, on fascism, because when we label people with a really strong pejorative, we dehumanize them to a certain amount, and that's not a healthy thing. And so that's, you know, I would say fascism. I'm a little more reluctant to say fascist, although I did say that I think Mitt Romney is a fascist, and because he's saying corporations are people, my friend. I think that's the definition of fascism, but I wouldn't go so far as to call them Nazis. But, I get what you're saying, and I know your heart's in the right place, Don. Thanks a lot for the call. Mike in Burien, Washington. Hey, Mike, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? And I hope your wife is doing fine, too.
She is. Thank you.
Okay, great. Yeah, getting back to the Fourth Estate or the Fourth Branch now, as you say, the fascist branch, Dan Rather was the last bastion that was taken off the list. And they destroyed him and destroyed our last path of true information from the government. I mean, one of the last. I mean, you folks are doing great. I'm not saying, you know, it ended. But
Dan Rather was the last guy on network television.
Right.
You know,
I mean, covered Vietnam. He knows what truth-telling is all about.
Yeah, he confronted Nixon, I mean, back in the day. He did.
Yeah, he was fantastic. Anyway, and getting back to fascism itself, I've been calling it that for 20 years. It's been going on and on and on. You know, it's piece by piece, bit by bit, corporations have been chewing away at our freedoms for over 20 years. I don't need to tell you that, but... And then one other quick thing was the callers are calling to talk about Democrats having to get their message out.
Right.
They can't, and we don't have the soapbox. We don't. You know, you made the point that we're fighting 9-1 the ratio of conservative radios to progressive.
Yeah, I think if you look at actual programming hours, it's probably more like 95 or 98-1. But yeah.
So we're kind of like beating our heads against the wall, but slowly but surely, it is working. It's just we don't have a big platform.
People are waking up. I mean, you know, Obama got elected president. It's not an extraordinary progressive victory, but it is a major step, particularly given that he ran on a platform of being a revolutionary, of fundamentally changing America and American politics. Now, you know, he didn't anticipate that, you know, 14 guys would get together in the caucus room restaurant the night that he was sworn into office and basically swear a blood oath to each other.
No.
You know, that they would obstruct everything he was going to do, but, you know, it's... Harry Truman who said, you know, if you want a friend in this town, get a dog? Anyhow, Mike, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. We need to start calling it exactly what it is. It is fascism. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be challenging conservative Mark Williams about the slippery slope of genetic testing. How much do you want to know? How much is too much and what are the consequences? Plus, get your questions ready for economist Dr. Ravi Batra. We're going to spend an hour with him. He'll be taking your calls. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active, tag you're it. Have a great evening. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.